Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Wednesday, the 12th of June, these are our main stories. The Russian campaigning journalist Ivan Golunov has walked free days after being arrested on trumped-up charges of drug dealing. It's a rare instance of the Russian authorities backing down in the face of public pressure. The opposition in Sudan are halting their campaign of civil disobedience after the military authorities agreed to release political prisoners. The current outbreak of Ebola has spread beyond the Democratic Republic of Congo. A case has been reported in Uganda. Also in this podcast,
the Villa Guadamangia was the backdrop for the early years of the Queen's marriage. Built in 1902, it was rented by Lord Louis Mountbatten. In 1949, he offered it as a residence to the 23-year-old Princess Elizabeth, as she then was.
The Royal Connection, that's put a $7 million price tag on a rundown house in Malta. First to Russia, where a crowd of hundreds of people in Moscow cheered the investigative reporter Ivan Golunov as he walked free after the authorities dropped all charges against him. He'd been accused of drug dealing. But the case had quickly become a cause célèbre. In a rare public show of support, Russian newspapers had rallied around the freelancer, running banner headlines on Monday proclaiming, "We are Ivan Golunov." This is how the Russian Interior Minister, Vladimir Kolokotsev, announced that the case was being dropped.
As a result of comprehensive biological fingerprinting, forensic and genetic tests, a decision has been made to terminate the criminal case against citizen Golunov and drop charges against him because his involvement in the crime has not been proven. He will be released from house arrest today.
The minister also said that the two police officers involved in the initial arrest had been suspended. Olga Ivshina is from BBC Russian. Tim Frank spoke to her about the circumstances surrounding the reporter's release.
Out of nowhere, you know, the police statement came. So the head of the Russian Interior Minister just released a statement that following all the checks, DNA checks and medical checks, the evidence just didn't stay together. And that's why they decided to drop charges and Golunov will be released soon, he said. And eventually, in a few hours, he was released and now he's free.
Well, we've just seen pictures of Mr. Golunov leaving the police station, cheered by several hundred supporters. I mean, it's a remarkable turnaround.
It's such a relief, you know. For the first time in the last, 4 days, we saw Ivan not crying. We saw him smiling. And it's unprecedented, you know. Everything in this story is unprecedented. For the first time in the history of Russian press, three main newspapers went with identical headlines. For the first, well...
And those headlines, I mean, they were striking, weren't they?
They were striking.
"We are Ivan Golunov."
Exactly. And the support was striking. And the fact that, you know, in the court hearing, he was put under house arrest. He didn't remain in custody. Was also remarkable. This rarely happens in relation to the cases on drug charges. And the fact that allegations were dropped, it's amazing. And as Ivan said, one of his first words were, "The best thing to me would be if this never happens to anyone again."
So the question is, why? Why did it happen to him? I mean, in terms of him being released,
it's hard to say at the moment. No one really knows, you know, but it seems it all coincided. Well, first of all, Ivan is really well, he's not a celebrity, but among his colleagues, among his colleagues, he was known as a really good investigative journalist. His investigations were really bright. His colleagues knew that he received some threats, and some other independent journalists, including people I know and myself, we also received threats. So many journalists felt connection to the case. And then when the case became public and, you know, the coverage was huge. But the thing is, many ordinary people all over Russia also felt that connection, personal connection to the case, because many, many, many Russians afraid that one day, at any time, at any place, they can just end up in prison with drugs being planted to their backpack.
Was it also that they were interested in, maybe applauded, the investigations that he did, which particularly were into corruption, official corruption?
You see, his investigations mainly related to Moscow. So they were mainly interesting to people living in Moscow. But the thing which really resonated with the public was the case, drugs being found. And people saw that, you know, he's an ordinary guy. There were really many inconsistencies in this case from the very beginning. There are many questions to the work of police in Russia. Polls show that total majority of Russians don't trust the police. And this criminal article, 228, is unofficially called People's Article because thousands of cases each year, you know, have relation to drug allegations. And 25% of all prisoners in Russia are there because of drug allegations. But at the same time, mathematical statistics show that almost 100% of the guys who were detained had exactly amount needed to case to be open. So it's never too little or too much. It's always exactly as much as you need to open the case. And it doesn't prove anything, but it raises many, many questions among everyone, among public.
That was Olga Ivshina from BBC Russian talking about the release of the reporter Ivan Golunov. And next to Sudan, where protest leaders and the ruling military council have agreed to resume talks. The opposition had suspended the negotiations following the violent attacks against protesters last Monday, which are said to have left more than 100 people dead. The news was announced by Mahmoud Dreer, an Ethiopian special envoy trying to mediate in Khartoum.
They agreed to uphold what they have agreed upon before the suspension of the negotiations regarding the structures, powers, responsibilities of the transitional government. Talks will resume soon in good faith to iron out outstanding points, including the Sovereign Council and other relevant matters.
I spoke to our correspondent in Khartoum, Catherine Biaruhanga, and asked her what compromises the two sides had made.
It looks like the opposition have made the biggest concession, which has been to stop their nationwide strike. Obviously, there is a caveat that as the strike went on, people really couldn't stay home. Some people have to try to earn a daily wage to make ends meet. So it did seem like the civil disobedience wasn't really working. But still, the fact that they've made this public announcement that they'll stop the nationwide strike does seem like a big concession. On the other hand, what we understand from the Ethiopian envoy is that the military have agreed to release political prisoners. This is something that they've done before. And according to Ethiopian envoy, they've said that they're going to do again. But remember, when the opposition called for this national strike, they made a list of six big demands. The biggest of these was to have an international independent investigation into the killings of over 100 people over the past week. They haven't received that concession. So there will be questions as to why the opposition have agreed to call off the strike, considering they haven't received most of their demands.
And it seems unclear to me at this stage whether or not all the opposition groups are on board. What do you know about that?
Well, what we have is a statement from the Declaration of Forces for Freedom and Change. They say, OK, we've agreed to call off the strike. Now, the interesting thing is about these talks that the Ethiopian envoy has said are going to start soon. From the people we've spoken to within the opposition alliance, they say, well, what we've agreed to is to continue the mediation, to speak to the international envoy, the Ethiopian envoy, but we're not going to engage in direct talks with the military council. That does seem a bit like semantics, because at the end of the day, they're still going to be talking about, you know, the big issue in Sudan right now, whether the military will hand over to civilians.
Catherine Biaruhanga in Khartoum. The World Health Organization says the current outbreak of Ebola has spread to Uganda. The first patient outside the Democratic Republic of Congo is a 5-year-old Congolese child who had travelled to Western Uganda. The child is receiving treatment. Richard Galpin reports.
The boy entered Uganda with his family on June the 9th and is now being looked after in a hospital just inside the Ugandan border. It had long been feared Ebola would spread from the Democratic Republic of Congo to a neighbouring country, and after many previous alerts, it has finally happened. A rapid response team has been sent to the area to find any other people who may now be at risk. The Ugandan authorities have already vaccinated more than 4,000 health workers in case Ebola did reach the country.
Richard Galpin. Several thousand people gathered outside Hong Kong's Legislative Council complex ahead of a second reading on Wednesday of a controversial extradition bill. The crowd was not deterred by heavy rain. There was tight security around the building and young people were stopped and searched in the vicinity. So what can the protesters achieve? On Tuesday night, I spoke to our reporter Danny Vincent, who was at the protest in Hong Kong.
There are hundreds of protesters. Many are singing. There's a Christian group singing hymns. There's also a small group of people sitting on the side. They're staging a hunger strike. The people that I've spoken to this evening say they're going to try to stay until the early hours of tomorrow morning when this controversial bill will be heard.
And I gather there are also plans for a strike on Wednesday as well.
That's right. I mean, on Sunday, organisers say that up to a million people, in fact, more than a million people, took to the streets of Hong Kong. But of course, Wednesday is a working day. But many companies have said they're allowing their workers to have flexible hours so they're able to come here and protest against this very controversial bill.
So, Danny, you say it's controversial. Just remind people why it is so.
It's because Hong Kong is part of China, but 22 years ago it was given back, it was handed back to China after being a British colony for more than 100 years. Now, Hong Kong has certain freedoms that the rest of China do not possess, things like freedom of expression, freedom of assembly, and of course an independent judicial system. Many people here in Hong Kong feel if this bill is passed, it will mean that any Hong Kong citizen could technically be summoned to mainland China and face trial for things that the mainland government consider a crime.
Well, I mean, the chief executive of Hong Kong, Carrie Lam, says, look, it's nothing of the sort. She's not going to withdraw the proposal. She says it's all about extraditing murderers and other people who've committed serious offences.
That's right. She's also said that this law, if passed, it will be used only on a case-by-case scenario. But that hasn't satisfied people here. Even before the 1 million man march on Sunday, 3,000 lawyers took to the streets of Hong Kong to protest against this law. Many people think that if it's not scrapped, it should at least be delayed. But tomorrow, potentially hundreds of thousands will come to the government offices to protest some more. They feel they're simply not being listened to.
That was Danny Vincent in Hong Kong. A small island in the Atlantic may point the way for the rest of the world when it comes to going fossil free. Porto Santo, in the Portuguese territory of Madeira, has come up with an experiment which involves storing power in the batteries of electric cars as a backup to the island's electricity grid. The cars top up their batteries from solar power when the sun's shining. That electricity is then sold back for use at night to power people's homes. From Porto Santo, here's our energy and environment analyst, Roger Harabin.
Like many small islands, Porto Santo relies on imported energy. It comes in the form of diesel and fuel oil. It's dirty and polluting, and it's expensive. The local government would like to get rid of it.
Porto Santo is aiming to become the first world's fossil-free island, and it is important to continually involve the community, create awareness, and make them understand that we are just starting a big thing that is going to bring huge changes to our island.
That's a promo video from local government. Their big thing is a radical plan to switch away from diesel-powered generation and onto wind and solar energy. The key question is how to secure that energy at night time when there's no wind or sun. The answer is this electric car. It looks like a standard model filling up its battery when the sun is shining. But there's a crucial innovation here. This car's battery can work in reverse when the sun goes down and give energy back to the grid to power people's homes. Here's Eric Funtum from the car's maker, Renault.
Everybody is using his car 10, 15, 20% of the time for driving, and the rest of the time your car is standing somewhere and the car is somehow a battery which is standing next to the electricity grid. The idea of the project in Porto Santo Island is to use the car as a storage when it's standing to help the electricity grid manage a lot of renewable energy.
The battery cars will be smart, so they'll know just how much electricity they can afford to sell while still leaving enough for the morning drive to work. To help persuade drivers on what passes for Porto Santo's busiest road to join the electron revolution, the local government will offer subsidies to make electric cars compare on price with petrol and diesel vehicles. Veronica Brandmeier from Mobility House, that's the company behind the reversible chargers, says people need to calculate the hidden benefits too.
So what we're doing here is really exciting, because normally you would think if you own a car, it costs you a fortune, it costs you a lot of money. If you have a car that can feed energy back into the grid, you can actually earn money during the time it's parked. If there's no renewable energy available, you can feed it back and you earn money. So it really changes the whole idea of owning a car.
The local government needs half the cars on the island to be battery powered to guarantee enough storage for an adequate backup to renewables. The electric revolution will reach into homes and workplaces. In the kitchen of the island golf club, the chef Daniel is cooking on gas. Before long, he'll be frying on electrons that have been carted round the island in somebody's car battery. A bizarre idea, perhaps. But some experts think that sooner or later, the rest of the world will follow.
That was Roger Harabin reporting on the island of Porto Santo in the Portuguese territory of Madeira. Now, what if there was a podcast that had the power to fix all of the world's problems? Well, that might be wishful thinking, but there is a podcast from the BBC World Service that explores brilliant solutions to different problems and talks to the people with the ideas. It's called People Fixing the World. And in recent episodes, we've heard about an ambitious project to swap mosquitoes that spread diseases with ones that don't, and the company where people are working less but getting the same amount of work done for the same pay. Find out how by searching for People Fixing the World wherever you found this podcast. The charity Oxfam allowed a culture of tolerating poor behaviour and failing to report child abuse claims in Haiti. That's according to a damning new report. The Charity Commission has examined Oxfam's handling of allegations that its aid workers used prostitutes following the 2010 earthquake in Haiti. Baroness Stoll is the chair of the Charity Commission.
This is an organisation which is all about relieving poverty and helping vulnerable people around the world. And they lost sight of that. They lost sight of the people that they exist to serve. And we saw that in the way that they responded to events in Haiti, in their reporting to the Commission and to other bodies. They seem to, by the fact that they didn't make a full disclosure, what we take from that is that they were putting their corporate reputation first.
Oxfam's chair of trustees, Caroline Thompson, said the charity had already made significant changes.
The Charity Commission report makes 79 recommendations of things we need to do. We've already done 59 of them and we're on course to do the rest. But ticking boxes of the changes is not enough. What we need to do in Oxfam is we have to create an atmosphere and a culture which accepts that safeguarding is everyone's responsibility. That's why we're putting every single member of staff through basic safeguarding training and 95% of them have already done it.
Well, Haiti's Minister of Foreign Affairs, Bucket Edmund, said the report confirmed the aid sector has been tarnished by sexual predators and even paedophiles. The BBC's Will Grant is in Haiti and told me more.
I think for Haitians, the part that angered them so much is the fact that it was something that they'd suspected was going on, not just with aid agencies, it should be said, in defence of the many people who come out here to Haiti to do good work and distribute aid donations and so on, but also foreign companies, foreign dignitaries of all sorts. They feel that there is a degree of impunity for abusing the very people they're here to support. And when that was proven in this case, obviously, we have that very angry response from the foreign ministry.
Sure. I suppose the added tragedy is that Haiti still is a country trying to come to terms with that earthquake, 9 years ago now, and it still needs quite a lot of overseas help.
Yes. I mean, if we just look at some of the numbers, it's still in the tens of thousands, those who are homeless after the earthquake. And, you know, and the aid that has come in since that time tops $7.5 billion. So, you know, there is much work to be done, and the aid agencies are crucial to the economy here. And Haiti is in a very complicated position right now as well, domestically in its politics. There are protests going on across the country. There are calls for the president to step down over a corruption scandal. So, you know, it's always very, very difficult here at the moment. It's particularly tough. And I think, you know, the scandal that went on with Oxfam just didn't really help. You know, it was just another complication to an already very, very complicated country.
That was Will Grant in Haiti. The Pacific nation of Samoa has banned the Elton John biopic Rocket Man because of its gay scenes. About 97% of the people there identify as Christian. Back in 2008, Samoa also banned the movie Milk, in which actor Sean Penn portrayed the homosexual American activist Harvey Milk. Stephanie Prentice has this report.
So how does it feel to be a star?
It's never going to last.
Let's just enjoy it while we can.
Featuring struggles with drug dependency, homosexuality and a romantic relationship with his manager, Rocket Man takes viewers on a journey through the life of Elton John.
People don't pay to see Reg Dwight. They pay to see Elton John.
But under Samoa's 2013 Crimes Act, sodomy is deemed an offence punishable by up to 7 years in prison. Defending the decision to ban the film, censors said the sexual activity on screen violated those laws and didn't sit well with the country's conservative beliefs.
First sleeping arrangements get out, all of this is gone.
Elton John has already been forced to defend the story of his life against censors. Earlier this month, he rejected a Russian film company's decision to cut all scenes which didn't comply with Russia's self-described gay propaganda laws. No. Rocket Man isn't the only recent movie to fall foul of gay censorship. 2017's Beauty and the Beast adaption was banned in Kuwait and Malaysia after the male character LeFou took part in a dance with another man and was accused of longing glances. And it's not just gay scenes that have upset censors.
I used to want to save the world.
2017's Wonder Woman was pulled from distribution in Lebanon due to the movie's lead, Gal Gadot, being an Israeli citizen. In 2015, Iraq rejected American Sniper, the Bradley Cooper war movie, for being an insult to the population. And the Philippines currently has a ban on all films starring the American actress Claire Danes after she said Manila was full of cockroaches and rats, and they found her subsequent apology to be insincere.
Stephanie Prentice reporting. The New York Times has announced that it will no longer publish daily political cartoons in its international editions. The decision was made after the publication of a cartoon earlier this year depicting the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and President Trump. In a written statement, the New York Times editorial page editor James Bennett defended the decision to do away with those daily cartoons.
We plan to continue investing in forms of opinion journalism, including visual journalism, that express nuance, complexity, and strong voice from a diversity of viewpoints across all of our platforms. Just last year, the New York Times, for the first time in its history, won a Pulitzer in the category of political cartooning for a nonfiction series by Jake Halpern and Michael Sloan, telling the story of a Syrian refugee family. We intend to do more such work.
The latest news was broken by one of the two cartoonists under contract to provide the publication with regular satirical illustrations, Patrick Chapat. He's been telling Razia Iqbal how he helped bring the cartoon to both the International Herald Tribune and its successor, the New York Times International Edition.
The New York Times was a house that was known to not have political cartoons. It was a historical thing. When I was very young, in my 20s, crazily enough, I tried to convince the New York Times to have political cartoons. And that took some detours. I had to convince first the Herald Tribune back in Paris. And I've been working for them since 2001. And then basically the Herald Tribune became the New York Times and they did integrate political cartoons. We never had any controversy like the one that started this whole thing.
Well, let's look at that controversy. This goes back to just April this year. Describe the cartoon for us.
Well, it's hard to describe a cartoon, but so the New York Times has had a mix of in-house cartoons from me and a colleague in Singapore, and the rest of the time they would print syndicated cartoons in their international print editions only. So someone picked a cartoon from a colleague that was depicting Netanyahu on a leash with a blind Trump following Netanyahu, who was depicted as a dog with a Star of David around the neck. To me, that cartoon was problematic in many ways, and I don't think it should have been published in the New York Times. And that caused an instant outrage and controversy and a lot of furor, especially on social media. But there was a lot of that on the right-wing media, Fox News, Breitbart. Trump's son retweeted the cartoon. Netanyahu's son did as well. It was widely depicted as an anti-Semitic cartoon. I don't think the cartoonist had an anti-Semitic intent, but I think this was a poor cartoon that should not have been published.
And in that context, when you make that judgment about that cartoon, do you think that the New York Times should have just apologized for that one and carried on with the tradition of publishing cartoons?
Well, I hoped that they would do that, because what they did is apologize, which was the right thing to do, and then they drew the line of what is acceptable and what is not. And they decided right away to suppress syndicated cartoons. And now, a few weeks later, they are suppressing cartoons altogether, including the one we've been doing, especially for the New York Times. And I think that's a bit worrisome, because I'm afraid it's not just about cartoons. Very often when these things happen, when furor gathers on social media and falls open newsrooms like a storm, the media find themselves very poorly prepared for that, very often. And it's funny, because the job of the media is to inform, analyze, and put things into perspective. But they're not very good at doing this about themselves. And I think we should have had a debate about that cartoon, to have to analyze the cartoon, to analyze the reactions, to analyze the whole context. Instead of that, I think there was a lot of damage control, and I think the media should stop being afraid of angry mobs. Twitter is a place for furor, not for debate. And very often, the most angry people define the conversation, and then they get you trapped into that conversation.
Do you see this as the beginning of the end of the political cartoon, given that a newspaper as august as the New York Times couldn't resist the furore that you speak of?
Of course not. It's a paradox, but I think this is the age of cartoons. This is the age of images. And another paradox is that I'm describing the power, the unjust power that social media has, but it's also something, social media and the internet, that is giving incredible exposure to political cartoons. And in this era of short attention span, the power of the image has never been so big. And we need humor in this crazy, crazy world more than ever.
That was Patrick Chabat speaking to Razia Iqbal from his home in Switzerland. And the New York Times says it does plan to continue working with him and his colleague on new projects. The only place outside the United Kingdom that Queen Elizabeth has ever called home is up for sale. Estate agents in Malta have put the Villa Guardamangia on the market for about $7 million. Our Europe regional editor Mike Sanders has this report.
The Villa Guardamangia was the backdrop for the early years of the Queen's marriage. Built in 1902, it was rented by Lord Louis Mountbatten. In 1949, he offered it as a residence to the 23-year-old Princess Elizabeth, as she then was, and the Duke of Edinburgh, who was based in Malta as an officer in the Royal Navy. Their son, Prince Charles, born the year before, stayed in Britain. The young couple were at the centre of society life, as this newsreel suggests.
The hosts are the Saddle Club, the guests of honour, the Princess and the Duke. An evening of gaiety Valletta will long remember.
She clearly has fond memories. As Queen, she's asked to see the villa on her return visits. Despite its Grade 2 listed status, it has become dilapidated. Conservationists have accused the owners of letting it fall into ruin so it can be sold to developers for demolition or conversion into apartments. The Maltese government has previously said it wants to buy it as a tourist attraction and heritage site.
Mike Sanders. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.
Capital One is building a better bank, one that feels nothing like a typical bank. It's why they've reimagined banking and built something completely different, Capital One Cafes. They offer checking accounts with no fees or minimums and savings accounts with one of the best savings rates in America. This is banking reimagined with your needs in mind. Open an account today at any Capital One location or online in 5 minutes and experience banking reimagined for yourself. Capital One. What's in your wallet? Capital One N.A. Member FDIC.